I'm Bill Castle, and this is Free Expression. This program is all about conveying the Christian message from a Catholic point of view and defending the liberty which makes it possible to do that. We talk with creative, interesting people bringing the spiritual reality of the Mass alive in a stunning visual representation and demonstrating the authenticity of Scripture. Join us. Sit back and enjoy some free expression. One claim among non-believers is that nobody can really be sure that the Bible is a true record of events, or that what we read in Scripture today is an accurate rendering of what the authors actually wrote. And that's not an entirely meritless charge. The books of the New Testament were written over an extended period, in some cases decades after the fact. We can't just say we know the Bible's true because people have always believed it's true. Any intellectually honest defense requires some work, and Scripture scholar Gary Mishuta has put in that work. He's got a new book out from Emmaus Road Publishing titled The Gospel Truth, How We Can Know What Christ Taught, and he's here to tell us about it. Gary, thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Okay, how do you address claims like the Bible is fiction, or that its content has been distorted over time, or any of the other objections that doubters often raise?
Well, you know, there's a couple of things you could do. First, you have to set the stage, so to speak. You know, I think that most people today really never heard of Jesus, unless it's just they might have heard his name in movies or, you know, on the streets or something, but they don't really know who he is or why he's important. And that kind of sets the stage to point out that here you have this first century rabbi who was crucified, and his followers claim that he rose from the dead. And from this movement, this tiny little movement out in the middle of nowhere, it revolutionizes Western civilization. And you have to ask yourself a question, what's so important about this Jewish rabbi that was 2,000 years ago that he would have this impact not only back then, but you know, throughout the West and even today? And then once you understand that, then you say, well, let's look at the claims. Like, what do his followers claim about Jesus? And we have, of course, the four Gospels. So at that point, we just look at the four Gospels, not as inspired writings, but as testimony. In my book, what I do is I show that Jesus deliberately plugged himself into the Jewish culture. The Jewish culture was unusual because it had a mechanism for passing on vast amounts of detailed information accurately from one generation to another through a rabbi and disciple relationship. So we look at the Gospels, we see that the features of this mechanism is being used by Jesus. Then we look at the text itself. What you find is some strange things. First, you know, the earliest manuscripts we have, the Gospels, are in Greek. But there is evidence that the Greek Gospels actually rely on an earlier either Hebrew or Aramaic tradition. And we find evidence that there are memory devices that are kind of layered within the New Testament Gospels. And these devices, some of them you can see in Greek, but some of them are hidden. So the Greek kind of sounds like it's speaking Hebrew. And what you find is that there's a layer by layer of pneumatic formatting. In other words, it's geared so that somebody could take this information and pass it on accurately. And that's probably the first half of my book I do that. I show, you know, if these things were frauds or legendary accounts, they are so over-engineered that a really strange credulity that that's what happened, right? Because if you're just going to come up with a legend or you're just going to embellish things, you're not going to try to format things in a way that can be easily recalled, right? You just tell your story. And you definitely wouldn't hide them so that your readers wouldn't see them unless they were Hebrew speakers and they picked up on these memory devices. The next question is, well, okay, fine, we have these Gospels. They look like they're formatted for accurate recall. How do we know that they told the truth? And I think that's really the big question. Could they have lied? Could they have fabricated? could they have over embellished? Could they have added the miracle claims and things later on? For me, I think that's probably the most interesting question.
Yeah. How can we know that these things were not imaginative additions or fanciful interpretations or anything?
I use the analogy of cashing a check. Okay, if you go to the bank and you have a $5 or a $10 check, the teller will run it through and you get your money, no problem. But if you have a check for, let's say, $20,000 or $100 or $1 million, it's going to take some time. They're going to call up the other bank. They're going to check to see the funds are there. You're going to have to ID yourself. You're going to have to go through this whole rigmarole before you get the $1 million because there's risk involved. Because if the check bounces, the bank is out $1 million. So they're going to be very cautious giving you the money. They're going to check it out. And what you find in the Gospels is the Gospel writers write some really big checks in regards to the claims of Jesus, that he claimed to be Yahweh, the one God of Israel, that he performed miracles to show that he is God, some really amazing stuff. So you bet that the first generation definitely would have verified whether the information in the Gospels are true. And in my book, I show several examples of where you can actually see in the Gospels themselves that the first Christians were verifying these things. Let me give you just one example. This is something you probably read 100 times or you heard it at Mass 100 times, never really paid attention to it. This is a text that most Catholics are very familiar with, John 6, the Bread of Life Discourse, where Jesus says, "You must eat my flesh and drink my blood. If you don't eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no life within you."
Right.
And, of course, you know, we see that as pertaining to the Eucharist. But as you're reading through this narrative, Bill, you probably notice right after he says all these really striking things about eating flesh and drinking blood, suddenly the narrator jumps in. It's almost like those old-time broadcasts. I'm sure you remember this. Whenever there was breaking news, the announcer would come on and say, "We interrupt this program to give you a special announcement," and then they'd say what it is, and then they'd say, "And now back to our regularly scheduled broadcast."
Right.
Well, the narrator does that in John 6. It's like out of the blue, right after Jesus says these striking things, the narrator jumps in and he says, "Jesus said these things while preaching in the synagogue of Capernaum. Now back to your regular scheduled program." You know, it's like, it's like, why did he feel the need to jump into the narrative and tell people who he was talking to and where it was located? Hmm. You know, I call this a dare to verify. It's like the gospel writer realized what Jesus just said there was so striking that even his own readers would doubt that Jesus actually said it. And so he has to jump in and he says, "Look, here's the location. Just go to Capernaum. Go to the synagogue, ask the people there, and they'll let you know that he actually said this stuff." And so you have all these dares to verify, like double dog dares, too, because they're very specific. Where Jesus does miracles, they name names. He does it multiple occasions with different audiences, with skeptics. So the first readers, the first century readers, were in the opportunity to verify. They did verify it, and they believed that these things were so. In fact, the very beginning of Luke's gospel, the whole point of the gospel was that Luke reinvestigated everything accurately and new so that he could put everything in an orderly account for this guy named Theophilus who was being catechized. So there's really good grounds to believe that the gospels are telling the truth simply because those who were there in the first century could have verified it, and they did verify it.
How would you address the complaint, which is also one of the common criticisms that are made, that there are disparities and contradictions from gospel to gospel? We see events that may be mentioned in more than one gospel as occurring at different times in Jesus's ministry, or we will see details emphasized in one gospel that don't show up in another. How do you handle that?
If you're approaching the Gospels as a non-believer, you're really looking at them as just pure historical documents, maybe like eyewitness accounts. And there's a really good book out there. It's by a former investigative police detective called Cold Case Christianity. And he actually, he converted because when he started reading the Gospels, he realized the Gospel sounds a lot like legitimate testimony of eyewitnesses. And one point he makes is that when you're interviewing witnesses to an event, let's say a 7-Eleven is robbed, and you have three different accounts, and one account says there was only one person who robbed, another account says that there was one person who was at the counter and two other people in the back, and then a third person says that there were actually four people, the person who at the counter, two in the back, and a driver outside. If you read the accounts separately, it seems to be contradictory, because one says one, the other one says two, and the other one says three. But with eyewitness accounts, you know, frequently people are so focused on one particular aspect of what's going on, they often miss details. And so you could have different accounts that will differ and seem to be contradictory, when in fact that's just legitimate testimony of how people, you know, multiple people viewing the same thing will give their recollections. And ultimately, when you put them all together, you do get a harmonious view of what actually occurred.
It does appear that archaeology has verified quite a few key points in the New Testament. They're finding ruins and artifacts that seem to suggest that the events actually happened and in specific locations. Do you touch on that aspect of it?
There's some very good books out there by evangelicals who do a fantastic job tying archaeology, extra-biblical history to the text. I actually take a different text. Usually they're very light on whether or not the Gospels are truthful. One thing they miss, and this is an objection non-believers give that I think is really a good question, is, fine, even if these texts we have actually do reflect the original, and even if you could say that it seems as if they're telling the truth, how do you know the proper interpretation? Because it seems like you could have one text, and every church has its own spin on what exactly Jesus is teaching. So, you know, even if you check all the boxes, you still have a problem of what's the proper interpretation of meaning that Jesus was giving. So that was another question that I raised in my book is, well, how do we know we have the correct interpretation? And the answer, Bill, is something that I think Catholics are in a unique position to supply, and that is that this community, the first disciples, continued throughout history and then grew. And so, you know, I take you through a thought experiment. It's like, okay, if you were sitting in a church and, say, the Apostle John is preaching from his own gospel, and he does the Bread of Life discourse, and you're not really sure whether or not the text supports his interpretation, how could you verify whether it's true? Well, you could go to John and ask him after Mass, you know, was that really what Jesus meant, that it was about the Eucharist? And if you doubt John, you could go to some of the other apostles there around and check them. And if they all have the same account, then you know that that must have been what Jesus meant. Then I say we go in the time machine, we go a generation later, let's say to Ignatius of Antioch's church, who was a disciple of John. John's no longer living, and Ignatius is preaching on the Bread of Life, and he says that this is Eucharistic. And how can you verify? Well, you could check with Ignatius, okay? And you can also check with the members of the congregation, because they were around, they knew the apostles, and they knew the bishop before Ignatius, what he preached, and just see, you know, was this something new Ignatius is making, or was this something that was handed on? And then you could even go a step further and go to other churches that were known to be established by the apostles and see what they teach. And again, if you have this consensus, that points to a point of origination that goes back earlier, which would be Jesus. So it's through the church that we learn the proper interpretation of certain texts. So it's not only just copying the Gospels, it's not only being able to verify the Gospels are true, but even the meaning itself, is all of that is passed on through the church, and all of that is verifiable.
The book is The Gospel Truth, How We Can Know What Christ Taught, by Gary Mishuta. Where can people find out about it?
Well, they can find it on Amazon, or you could go to stpaulcenter.com. It's stpaulcenter.com.
Gary Mishuta, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Heaven is often described as a great and continuous celebration of God and His love. What we see in our earthly worship is an echo of that eternal sharing of joy, but let's face it, we don't always look at the Mass through the eyes of faith, and so, unfortunately, we can fail to appreciate what a profound event is taking place before us. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could see in a tangible and immediate way what the angels and the saved witness in heaven continuously? Well, there's a lovely little film circulating online that attempts to show us that. It's called The Veil Removed, and Chris Magruder, the woman behind that production, is here now. Chris, thanks for speaking with us.
Wow, thanks for having me, Bill. It's great to be on with you.
Well, what's the story behind this production? How did it come about, and what's your involvement with it?
Back in 2014, I actually have been a radio co-host on a show called Catholic Women Now on Iowa Catholic Radio, and we do our own programming. And I came across a little booklet about a woman who had seen the veil removed at Mass one time. Her name's Catalina Rivas. And after reading about that, I thought, wow, that's something we should talk about on our radio show, which my co-host Julie Nelson and I did. And following that, we went to a noon Mass. And during the noon Mass, the priest was lifting up the host, saying, "This is my body," transubstantiation, the most powerful part of the Mass, as I'm concerned. And I could hear in my mind my spiritual director saying, "Hey, remember, this is a really powerful time to ask the Lord for those important prayers for you." I just, you know, kind of had a little thought that way. And so I said, "Lord, if everybody could see the veil removed, nobody would leave your church. They would get it." And all of a sudden, something happened to me that isn't normal. Not normal for me, that is. And I heard the Lord say to me, "Then show them." And I literally looked around like, who's talking to me? Because that is not normal for me. And I heard him say it again, "Show them what they would see if the veil was removed." And honestly, back then, I didn't even quite, that wasn't language I would have used, you know, in 2014. Mm. But I knew what he meant. And not only did I know what he meant, you know, to show a short film, in short film, what you would see if you could go into Mass and that thin veil between heaven and earth were to be removed, but also I knew it was supposed to be a 3 to 5 minute short film, and it wasn't supposed to be animated. And so, you know, just he kind of shared some things with me. I didn't hear anything more, but I just kind of had a knowing. And very quickly, I shared this with my radio co-host as we were leaving, and she said, "You know what, I was praying for the same thing during the transubstantiation." And so as we walked out, I was just like so surprised, because she was immediately, my co-host, was immediately on board, and she said, "What film studio should we work with?" And I'm thinking to myself, what? This is crazy. She said, "I think we should work with Spirit Juice Studios." I didn't even know who Spirit Juice Studios was at the time, but they are a Catholic film studio out of Chicago area who actually works with Bishop Robert Barons. Yeah. But long story short, we looked at other studios. We put a lot of it to prayer. And after a few months and put together a prayer team and all, we ended up working with Spirit Juice Studios in 2019 to film what you see online now, The Veil Removed. And it was really, truly an amazing experience. And there were a lot of little miracles that happened along the way to even get to 2019. But it was a beautiful project of God's, truly not ours, but he let us be the hands and feet. So it was quite an adventure to be on.
Well, this kind of independent production could have been really low end and primitive, but boy, oh boy, you just went to the top production values. It's stunning. It's beautifully done. Everything from the casting to the lighting to the setting to it was just beautifully planned out.
Thank you. And honestly, so much of it was God. There were so many stories along the way where the Lord brought the right person for the right character. Even the lady who, if you've seen the film, if your listeners have seen the film, there's a lady, she's an older lady, she has the big glasses on. While she was sitting there during filming, we were looking at a large styrofoam blue cross while we were in the church filming. But she actually had a moment where the Lord allowed her to see him on the cross. Hmm. And he said to her from the cross, he said, "Even if this only helps one soul, this film will have all have been worth it, all the work, all the money that it took." And so we were having miracles during filming happening. Lots of cool miracles happened to get us to the point of even being able to make the film too, in raising money, in, you know, having bishop support and all those different kinds of things that it takes to get something like this done.
I guess that's the first thing that comes to my mind. There was some budget in this. You spent some serious money. It shows on screen.
Right. And, you know, that was the other thing that came to me on that very first day, that it was not supposed to be done in an amateur way. My initial thought was, oh, you know, we'll get some college kids to kind of help us do something, and we'll be done in 2 or 3 months. And not so. The Lord wanted it to be done very well. Matter of fact, we had people that were working on Arnold Schwarzenegger films, you know, to do our special effects. They brought people in from Los Angeles and all over. I mean, it was quite a big production crew, and it was really amazing how well they worked together. Matter of fact, we had one young woman be so surprised how smoothly everything went, even when we got behind at times, that she, being an agnostic herself, asked some of the Catholic film producers, tell me more about your Catholic faith. How do I learn about it? How do I become Catholic? Because there was so much that could have gone wrong, but that was handled so peacefully, and I don't think that all production companies, you know, handle it the same way, that she was impressed just with the way she saw people living their faith on set. And so not only was it something where we were spending a lot of money, but the Lord was spending a lot of His resources and just doing all the little details behind the scenes, making things work to bring people into the faith and to learn more about Him and to be curious and to fall in love with Him as well, just through the process of making the film.
It certainly demonstrates the power of good visual communication. What are your intentions with this? How do you expect this film will be used other than just rolling online?
So far, across different platforms, we've had 24.5 million views, which is amazing. And truly, we couldn't have done that. Matter of fact, I mean, you know, it's considered an old film right now. It came out in December of 2019, and yet we just had another 100,000 new views. And so it's getting used, I can tell you, by priests who show it at Mass, and then they talk about it in their homilies. It's being used by people who run RCIA programs, RE programs. Catholic school teachers are using it. So it's being used kind of as a piece of catechesis. But I have people who, matter of fact, I just had a gentleman today tell me he uses it every day before he goes to Mass. It's kind of, he says, it's my pump me up film that I watch to prepare for Mass. So it's a sort of prayer for some people as well. But it's being used a lot of different ways, especially for catechesis purposes.
Well, unfortunately, this is radio. People are hearing our voices, but they're not looking at the film. Where can they find it?
And I will tell you that it's in 12 different languages, too. So if they go to theveilremoved.com, they can see it in several languages, actually, at theveilremoved.com. They could also see it on YouTube if they just go to The Veil Removed. But, you know, sometimes people take it and they'll adjust it and they'll put questions on top of it in their own different little pieces. So I just tell people it's best if they go to our website, theveilremoved.com, because they'll be able to see it in the language they want. They won't have the disruptions they want. And then there's also follow-up if they have different things that they would want to read about The Veil Removed, or if they had any intention to, you know, we have some materials, actually learning materials, that they can follow up with it. There's two different study guides. There is an actual parish retreat. There's a 33-day meditation guide. So there's things to also help people better understand what they're seeing in the film, because so many people see it and they go, wow, that's cool, but they don't fully understand what they're seeing. And that's even the people in the pews who are still going to church. You know, today we've lost a lot of people. But people that are in the pews, who is, you know, really who the Lord showed me He wanted this film to be made for, they're the ones who still need to be catechized as well. We just don't know what's really taking place at Mass so many times.
TheVeilRemoved.com. If anybody wants to show this in their church, are there any rights and permissions concerns? Or,
you know what? They really don't have to get our permission. We do have parishes that will ask for our permission, but they really don't need our permission. We just want people to use it as much as they can, show it to as many people as they can, and get it into as many eyes and ears as possible, so that we get people inciting curiosity and getting people to figure out, wow, you know, there's more to this Mass than what I saw and understood. The power of, you know, the fourth cup and how time collapses in Mass. You know, so many things people don't understand is that time collapses in Mass. When you go to Mass, yes, you're there in the present, but the Lord also brings us into the time of Jesus's crucifixion and into the time of the Last Supper. And, you know, there's all sorts of powerful information as to why He brings us to those points in time. But I think people don't realize it's kind of like a time warp when you go to Mass. You know, you're actually in three different times than just the present moment. And so It's so powerful to think that Jesus is actually there dying on the cross. We are actually at Golgotha with him as he dies on the cross, and we are actually with him at the Last Supper. It's a real true thing that's happening.
Well, it's a powerful piece of visual communication. I urge everybody to go to theveilremoved.com. Chris Magruder, thanks very much for taking a couple of minutes to talk about it. It's a stunning work. I really congratulate you on it.
Thank you. God bless you, Bill.
Chris Magruder's lovely video, The Veil Removed, is a short but incredibly beautiful representation of the Mass. No audio discussion can do it justice. Take a couple of minutes and view it for yourself. Go to theveilremoved.com. If you've been listening to these shows online but would like to hear them on the radio, tell your local Catholic station. Free Expression with Bill Castle is available for broadcast free of charge. Ask your Catholic station to contact us by email, billcastle@sbcglobal.net. That's billkassel, all one word, billcastle@sbcglobal.net. And don't forget to support your local station. In this time of censorship and so-called cancel culture, Catholic radio is becoming increasingly important as an alternative media source. Our programming is based on the Word of God and the teaching of His Church, and we bring you the factual, truthful information you aren't getting from the mainstream media. Support Catholic radio. Your generosity keeps Catholic outlets on the air, and donations to broadcast ministries can be tax-deductible. And please, let me know what you think about these shows. Tell me what books you're reading, what media you follow, what sort of music communicates with your soul. I'd love your suggestions on topics we might explore that touch the lives of Catholics today, important ideas we might discuss, interesting people we might speak with. Email me with your thoughts, billcastle@sbcglobal.net. Be with us next time when we explore other aspects of religious communication and look deeper into the great Christian heritage of free expression. Free Expression with Bill Castle is a production of Good Shepherd Catholic Radio and Company Publications, where good books, good music, and good radio are always good company. Dan Kuras provided technical assistance. Theme and incidental music are by Dan Adam. The program was produced and directed by Bill Castle. This is Good Shepherd Catholic Radio.